I can understand a sheep, and I can understand a bell, and I can understand a wolf. But what about the serpent? He is wise as a serpent, he says, and as harmless as a bell. Now, I'm not going to tell stories tonight about snakes. But you know, a snake is a very, very wise animal. It has a long, slender body. And if you break its neck in any part, it's not able to do a thing. Do you remember what the Lord said to Moses? When he threw his rod on the ground and it became a serpent? He said, take it by the tail. Now, I have seen a man take a king cobra by the tail. And he would take it by the tail and hold it up like that, and the thing is completely held. And when you were to do that, you would break its back and you would kill it. It's a very, very, it's an animal that can be very physically hurt in a very easy way. And for that reason, it generally lies low. And the Africans have a proverb that says, the man has fear, so has his neck. And it will try to get out of your way. If it sees you first, it will try to get out of your way. It won't attack you unless it's cornered or fight just like a rat. And I think that when the Lord uses the metaphor here of wise as a serpent, I think there's a lesson for that too. Now I'm not going to tell stories because my time has rapidly run away. But I believe that we should be wise in our attitude to peace and our attitude to everything in the Lord's word. An old preacher in Ireland said this to me when I was reading home the first time. He said, brother, you'll need three things in the word of the Lord. The first thing, you'll need a head like a wise father. And the second thing, you'll need a heart like a loving mother. And he said, you'll need a hide like a mouse. So don't forget the head and the heart and the hide. You'll need the strength of Samson. You'll need the patience of Job. And you need the wisdom of Solomon in the work of the Lord. All this practical wisdom of the Lord is inculcating into these men as he stands before to do this work. Now, my friend, it's practically gone. I just want to conclude by a beautiful, beautiful little conclusion that we get to this chapter. And the principle here is hospitality. Loving, gracious, kindly hospitality. And the Lord speaks of five grades of hospitality here at the end of the chapter. He that deceiveth you, deceiveth me. He that deceiveth me, deceiveth him that sent me. He that deceiveth a prophet in the name of a prophet shall receive a prophet's reward. He that deceiveth a righteous man in the name of a righteous man shall receive a righteous man's reward. And whosoever shall give the drink unto one of these little ones a cup of cold water, only in the name of the disciple, wherein I say unto you, he shall in no wise lose his remark. My beloved brethren and sisters here tonight, this is one of the great miracles of Christianity. Gracious, kindly hospitality. You know, there are hundreds of homes in the middle of Africa. All we need to do is just to go and look at it. Knock the door, it's a half door. And they'll come out and they'll see you standing there, they'll bring you in and they'll give you the very best to have. You go out of your hands for it. And then maybe go to a house of a millionaire, a man who's in fellowship and in the family. And when he sees you, he'll bring you in and give you the best in the house. And here in the United States and in Canada, I don't know of any country, anywhere in the world, where this lovely trade is exemplified more than in this beloved country. He that giveth only a drink, a cup of cool water, in the name of the disciple, he shall in no wise lose his reward. Mind you, very often, very much more than a cup of cold water. Now we do thank God for gracious, kindly hospitality among God's people. Now just in conclusion, I want to read a little thing I picked up the other day connected with the servant of the Lord, written by Lord Beaverbrook. I was trying to find out a little bit about him today. He was born in Canada, I think over in Nova Scotia. His name was Max Bacon. And he became a very wealthy man and became the minister of supply to Winston Churchill during the last war. Now at the end of his life, this is what Lord Beaverbrook wrote, and I thought it was absolutely delightful. The title of it is The Evangelist. If I were in the position to influence the life of a sincere young man today, I would say to him, let never choose to be an evangelist, and a cabinet minister, or a millionaire. And he was both. He was both a cabinet minister and a millionaire. When I was a young man, I pitied my father for being a poor man and a humble preacher of the word. Now that I'm older, I envied him his life and career. This is life's real satisfaction. There is nothing I admire quite so much as the evangelist, the supreme source of satisfaction. Lord Jesus, isn't that delightful? And yet absolutely lovely. Here's a man who was a cabinet minister and a millionaire, but it is the evangelist. The preacher of the word is far surpasses anything that this world has to give. May God bless his word to our heart.
And on this afternoon, I'd like to give a little rundown of what we saw in both these areas. I want to leave a little time at the end for questions, because things that may not occur to my mind may occur to yours. On anything that you would like to know about either of these fields, we'd be very happy to answer if we possibly could. Now, the first place we visited was Angola. We spent about 20 years of our life there. I went there when I was 21 years of age, 1923, and I was well over 60 when I left there. So the main part of our life has been spent in Angola, part of the world that we really love, and where the Lord has very, very greatly blessed his work. Now, as far as Angola is concerned, I don't think I need to go into a lot of detail about the history of the work there. All I would like to say is, for those who are not familiar with the country, that the work was started by Mr. Fred Stanley Parnett about 80 years ago. And from that time up to the present time, it has been carried on continuously. And the Lord has wonderfully blessed his work in Angola. There are four main areas where work is going on. And in each one of them, I've not seen phenomenal blessings. I think that is the proper word to use for it. It has been in spite of many difficulties, and particularly during the past 12 years, when many of the Christians have suffered severely. Some of them have lost their lives. In spite of what has happened, the work has been purified, and the day is on a more solid basis than ever. And for that, we're awfully thankful. And Mr. Fred Stanley Arnett, he went there for the first time in 1881. He went to Africa. Spent about 2 years with an old chief called Moshidi in what is now Katanga in the Congo. And after that, he was invited by a Portuguese trader called Silva Porto to come up to West Africa to Angola. It took him about 6 months traveling on a riding horse. And he came up into Angola, and when he saw the country, he decided that here was a very good base for evangelizing the whole of Central Africa. He went back again in 1889, after a short furlough in England, and took about 10 workers with him. You probably know the story of how the disaster overtook the party from beginning to end. One man died before he actually landed at the coast, Robert John Johnson. A man who was a very effective evangelist at home, bitten by mosquitoes, died of yellow fever, and was buried at the coast. 200 miles from the coast up into the interior, two other men died in one night from malaria, a Mr. Morris and a Mr. Bob. And then another 100 miles up to an area called DA, that we want to speak about in a moment or two, another one was bitten by a mad dog and died of hydrophobia. There were 3 survivors left, an Englishman, an Irishman, and a Scotchman. And those were the 3 men that were mainly responsible for finding the work right across what we call the Beloved Strait. Now, as far as we personally were concerned, we first of all heard about Angola, and beneath there, I was 18 years of age at the time, and I had a sacred mind to devote my life to go out there and spend my life among the people. The man who told us about that was Mr. Fred Zane. He was an Englishman on the party. He had been a sergeant detective in Scotland Yard in London before he went to Africa. And he was one of those fine pioneers. Fine, big, upstanding man, and giant in every way. And I'm often thankful, 21 years of age when I went out there, I had a very great privilege of being associated with Mr. Fred James. You know, young people are liable to be critical. And I was too. And you know, when you watch a new field where you've never been before, you're liable to be critical of this and critical of that and critical of the other thing. I suppose it's something that's characteristic of most young people. But I never keep my mouth shut. And in those days, when I saw things that passed by, I thought might be done in a better way, I was quite up and critical inside. I kept it to myself. And I learned something. After 10, 20, 30, 40 years, I learned that what the men were doing in those days, after all, had a reason for it, and I believe that the Lord blessed it. There's one thing about those men. They were men of wide experience. They were men of godliness. Men who knew the book. And they lived on solid foundations of Assembly testimony at that time in Central Africa under this massive mark for over 50 years. We're awfully thankful for that. I think that is a test of any mission work. So the key of crisis in the work in Angola in 1961. We had been 40 years in the country at that time, and when independence came to the Congo, people in Angola, I'm not speaking about the Christians, but I'm speaking about the African population. They decided that they wanted independence too. Now, I don't want to go into the political side of this at all, but I should say that what has happened in Angola during the past 12 or 13 years, that those that have suffered, those that have been tortured and executed, were not guilty of any political activity against the government. Now, I know what I'm talking about here. We know the people, we know their languages, and we investigated very thoroughly last year, when they were over there, that the men who lost their lives were not involved in political activity of any kind. It took too long to describe just what has happened. But I believe at the present time, God's people should know what has happened to the work and how leadership in some areas has been completely wiped out by Portuguese troops. It might be as well just to a word or two the background to it. Now, I'm not saying this in any critical, unkind way at all, but the facts are facts, and we have to face up to them. There were some young men belonging to the Methodist Episcopal Church who had come out to Angola on a two-year basis, and they were living in Luanda at the coast, right under the eyes of the Portuguese government. Now, these young men who had had no experience whatever of the background of the country, they started some underground propaganda among the African population. And they told them that they were there to train them for the day when they would be independent and be able to take over the government. Now, when the Portuguese government heard what was going on, those young men were arrested. They were put in prison. And after a period of imprisonment, they were expelled from the country. They were deported and sent back to the United States. But the Portuguese at that time got the idea that this underground movement in the country was started and was being fomented by Protestant missions in the country. And for that reason, when the trouble came to a head, it was the Protestant missionaries and the Protestant Christians in the country that really suffered. Now, in 1951, the Portuguese, they sent out troops, and at the end, they must have had approximately 250,000 men in the country. And a guerrilla warfare started up. And the result was there was a head-on clash between the African population and the Portuguese government. Now, on behalf of the Portuguese, let me say this. The Portuguese have been in Angola since 1498. Now, that's about the same time that Columbus discovered North America. And they have been there all that time. And if you were talking to a Portuguese official, he would tell you, this is not a colony. This is a part of overseas farming. You know, it's under Kalam. We have been here for practically 500 years, and we have no intention whatever of getting out and handing over the country to a black African government. But with a head on clash. And at that time, guerrilla warfare started, and it spread throughout the country, and the result was that our African believers suffered very severely. Now just a word about the blessing that has been granted in the country, and just what has happened to these various assemblies that have been formed during the past 80 years. We personally have worked in three tribal areas. First of all, in B.A., that word is spelled D-I-E, B.A. And in that area, there's a tribe called the Omimundo. They speak the Omimundo language. One man is called an Ochimundo. The plural of that word is Omimundo. That is the name of the tribe. And the language they speak is Omimundo. And this is the oldest work connected with the language in Angola. Now the work there was started by Mr. Fred Samiari, Mr. C.A. Swan, Mr. George Maureen, Mr. Prentain, and in more recent years, Mr. Ed Hodley from London, Ontario. Now in this area, there are four stations today. There's first of all the Chilanda, and then Katanga, where we spent the last 20 years of our service in Angola, and then there's Chitano, where Ed Bodley worked for 50 years. And then the Scottish branch that was started by Dr. Alan Bodman and carried on by Charlie Sharton and Dr. Ross Woodward, who was here yesterday. Now these were the four stations in Angola. Now over the 80 years that work has gone on among the Umbundu speaking people, there are about 250 companies of us being among that, in that tribe, speaking the Umbundu language. Now let me just give a little word about the various workers that have worked there. At Chalanda, the oldest work, the work there was started by Mr. Arnett, and then later by Mr. Charles Swan, an Englishman from Sunderland in England. He was a giant of a man too. There were giants in those days. Wonderful man. I spent the first year of my missionary service with Mr. Swan in Portugal. I'm awfully glad I did. He was a great man. But he, along with Mr. Arnett, started the work at Chalanda. Then Mr. Edward Sanders from Liverpool in England, he came out and he spent 30 years at Chalanda. And then later, John Cole from the tribe, commander from the tribe, he came there. And then there was another lady who also had worked at Chalanda. There was in the early days, of course, there were a number there that long since have gone to be with the Lord. But Dorothy Schuchel has spent some time there at Chalanda. And Grace Sanders, who was born there, Grace, she has spent about 50 years in the work of the Lord. Dear, dear friend, all of these people are friends and brethren and sisters in Christ. Now, at Chalanda, there are approximately 450 in assembly fellowship, that is, at the station at Chalanda. And there must be between 60 and 70 outstations and assemblies in the whole area. Now, at Katanga, the work was started by Mr. Fred Lane from London, England. And over the years, a number of brethren have worked there too. We have five missionary graves at Katanga. There was Dr. Sparks, a man from Bath in England, medical doctor, who came out there and only spent 6 months in the country, died from tuberculosis. And he was the first man buried there. And then, later on, there were two ladies, Mrs. Justin, Mrs. Fred Lane, died. And then, Grace Smith. We had a very great privilege of being with Grace when she was dying. I'll never forget that experience. Dear, dear friend, one of the most gracious people I think I ever knew. We had a very great privilege, my wife and I, of taking care of her when she was dying, and then making her cash sick. and burning her. And then the final one, the lady on the right there, Pastor Pango, was Miss Annie Cannon. She had spent 53 years of faithful service for the Lord, Pastor Pango, and the last 23 years she didn't have a further job. She said, if I go home, the Brennan won't allow me to come back again, and I'm going to stay here until I die. Oh, what a privilege it was to be with that dear saint. Miss Cannon was a real saint in the true sense of the word. And she, after spending 53 years there at the Pango, the Lord took her home. Now, at the Pango, Mr. Leonard Devon was there for some time, and then his son Walter was her very dear fellow worker. Walter is a gentleman with a fingertips. Those that know Walter, I know, you know just what I mean. I have never seen Walter angry in my life. He is a perfect gentleman. And it was a real privilege to work with Walter and with Anna Hancock and others who lived there for years. So then they did at Capango. Approximately we had about 500 in attending fellowship at Capango. And in the area there were 83 artworks, many of them assemblies with the breaking of bread, and the work was spreading in every direction. Then up at Chicago for Ed Bodling. He went there in 1923 and he put in 50 years of hard work. He was a hard worker and he too did a magnificent work in that area. And then there was Dr. Bodlin and later Charlie Sharton and Dr. Woodward and Vivian Booker at Montesperanza. Now these are the four stations in VA. If I skip anybody's name, please forgive me. I'm just speaking from my memory. And I don't intend to miss anybody at all, but if I have missed anybody, it's not intentional at all. Now the work has been very greatly blessed in VA. And to a large extent, the Pango and Chelonga were untouched by the conditions that we find further in the interior. We were over there last year. We had the privilege of being with Betty Beatty. You know, unintentionally, I miss Betty's name. She is the only one there today. And you know, it was an emotional experience to go back again last year and spend a little while with her and take several journeys on a Land Rover all over this area that I have mentioned. But in any case, Betty is there alone today. And oh, what we're praying to God that he would raise up some young people from among the attendants today that would go over there and help in the work of the Lord. The four stations in VA speaking the Omundo language, Betty is the only one that is there today. We're thankful that there's a young couple, in particular at the present time, a young man called Dennis Williamson and his wife. We're very glad to see Mr. Hamilton in the meeting here this afternoon. He's one of the elders in the assembly that Dennis comes from. And we're thankful that Dennis is over there in Portugal today learning the Portuguese language with the object of going over to Angola. But in any case, VA has been very, very greatly blessed. Before the emergency, we used to have a conference there where we had 3,000 believers gather together for the ministry of the Word of God. And God has raised up elders, men who are able to preach the gospel and minister the Word in the most effective way among the Umundo-speaking people. So last year when we were over there, we had the privilege of visiting all four of these assemblies and having ministry of the Word among them in the Umundo language. Then we went on and lived here to the Joker Country. By the way, my wife and I were married there 27 years ago. And we had the privilege of spending some years among the Chokwe-speaking people learning the Chokwe language. Now, there has been a wonderful work among the Chokwe. I think it was David Livingstone who said that the most difficult time that he had met with in Africa was the Chokwe. He, of course, came through in 1853 before there was any mission work going on at all. He almost lost his wife with her hand. But Mr. William Maitland and Tom Lovett, they were in there in 1905 and founded the work. first of all at Bowen, and then over to Bueller, and then later on work was started at San Remo and also at Paisa by Mr. Robert McLaren. And then Cuthbert Taylor, one of the finest missionaries that ever went to Angola, went on to Lutheran Time. And he and Leonard Devon and Fred Alford and Malcolm McJanet, they started the work there at Lutheran Time and Bueller. Now, over the years, since 1905, again, a lot of the work was done. There must be today about 200 assemblies speaking the Chokwe language in Angola. It started off in a very, very small way, and for 8 or 9 years there wasn't a single soul saved. But we're awfully thankful to say that I've got a wonderful heart. They that sow in tears shall reap in joy. He that goeth forth and weepeth bearing precious seed shall darkness come again with rejoicing, bringing his sheaves with him. Now David Long spent a number of years at Lucas Time, and while he was there, he translated the whole Bible in the Chokwe. Now that's a colossal task. Anyone who has done any translation work at all, they know to translate one book or two books or three books of the Bible is quite a task. But David, working on the foundation that had been done by Mr. Malcolm Janet, he had translated the whole of the New Testament some years ago, but they were taking that translation and starting in Genesis, went right through the whole Bible and translated the Bible in Chokwe. And that has been completed, printed by the British Inquiry Bible Society, and today is being spread among the Chokwe speaking people right across Central Africa. You know, I can't say anything too high about these workers, these men who founded the work, and today the work is being carried on in Chokwe land by one man and four ladies. You know, that's rather pathetic. The one man who's there in Chokwe land today is George Whiteman, again a dear, dear friend. And with him, Abula, at the present time, is Marjorie Penquin. She is there. We're so glad to see her sisters here this afternoon. Marjorie Penquin, and a girl from Clarendon called Ina Bell. Ina, again, is a wonderful lady, efficient missionary. She is a nurse. And Dr. Peters said years ago that Ina Bell was as good as a doctor in any day. She's a wonderful, wonderful girl. And then there's Lawrence Pittman. She too is from Sherbrooke in Quebec. And then over at Louisville, at the main center there at Louisville, we find again a young woman, Elizabeth Davis, is working there. Now, we were able to go over to Chokwe land last year and see what has happened. And in many ways we were saddened by certain things, but in other ways we were very, very much encouraged by some of the things that we saw. I'm going to give a little outline of what happened in an area where we spent 16 years finding the work. My wife and I were married in 1927. And on our wedding day, we left Lumikasai and Chokwe land, and we had a honeymoon walk of 250 miles away up into the north of the country. It took us 13 days to walk up there, and when we got there, there was not a single Christian in the country. No fellowship of that whatever with anybody that we could even speak our own language to. We had been spending some years in learning Portuguese in London, Chokwe. And when we were up there, here was another language, the Songo language, that never had been committed to writing. And we had the privilege of doing the pioneer work in that language and in that area. And over the years, God very greatly blessed. When we went there after 16 years' work and came back to EA to help with the work among the Ubuntu speaking people, there were 22 centers where work was going on among the Songo people. Now, the Songo have been more hardly hit by the conditions that I have described at the commencement than possibly any other area. Now, what I want to say this afternoon about it, I want to be very restrained in what I say. I don't want to go into the sort of details of how the elders there were tortured and shot and how the work was almost complete to destroy my Portuguese troops. But before I do that, I want to mention the work again in Chopinana, and this is to say that at Poma, there was a center of work that was a tribute to the man who founded it and carried it on. The man who started the work there was William Aitken and Tom Lockett. And in more recent years, Dr. Leslie Deer, he went to Poma. And he started a hospital there, and he built it up from scratch. Now we have been there, and we have seen the work of that dear man that did, and it's beyond all praise. And not only that, but the Christians here in Canada and in the United States and other parts who have supported that work by their prayer and by their sacrificial giving, there's no word of mine could give higher praise for what has been done in that area. But during this emergency, Portuguese troops came in, and the hospital that was built by Ross Woodward at Montes Branca and by Dr. Beard at Poma was completely looted and destroyed. Portuguese troops, Portuguese soldiers sleeping on the bed. And as far as the spiritual side of the work is concerned, that has not suffered. And after all, material things are not important things. It's those that have been saved and the assemblies built up by these men of God that have remained and been strengthened and built up over the years and that stand today after the fire has passed over it, and that's what we're interested in and for which we are trying to thank. But in any case, that is the one side of the story. Now, in the Songbo area, Portuguese troops came in, the Methodists and the Baptists, they have worked along the coast. And I should say that the Baptist people that worked along the coast were truly born again believers. Some of the men I know, and I can testify that they were truly evangelical born again people. They suffered severely. Most of their pastors were shot, and the survivors that had to leave, and they had to go away up into the Congo and locate again around San Salvador in the Congo. And the work among the Baptists there was completely destroyed. The Methodist Episcopal people, they too had a large work from Rwanda up into the interior, and it too was almost completely wrecked and destroyed. The Portuguese soldiers, when they came up, went to these little villages, hard schools in the bush, the elder, or the man that was in charge of the place was taken out, and without any question, he was put up against a tree and shot. After they finished with the Methodists in that area, they came up through the Samba. Now again, I'm not going to go into detail, but those 22 places that I've already mentioned where work was going on, all the leadership was taken out. And without any questions being asked, they too were tortured, beaten up with clubs, and then shot through the back of the neck with a revolver. Some of them had to dig their own grave. Some of them were buried before they were dead. I know what I'm talking about. I investigated it thoroughly with the survivors, and all of these men I've known all my life. And I know that what I say is perfectly true. But for 12 years in the Songbo country, the Christians were forbidden to meet. Their books were taken from them. The little buildings, the halls in which they met to remember the Lord and the priest of the gospel were either destroyed or else handed over to the Roman Catholics. And the work, it just seemed as if it would be completely obliterated, completely destroyed. You know, we went back last year, and when we went up to the Songbo, what a reception we got. The survivors of these people, they come out and they threw their arms around our neck and sobbed and sobbed and sobbed. They said, we thought we'd never see you again until we get to heaven. Now, I was so much upset with such an emotional experience, I decided to go and see the Portuguese government. I took a long journey in a jeep up to a place called Malange. And there I was able to interview the Portuguese authorities and describe to them what had happened in that area. citizens to be right carefully, took everything down in my name. They said they would consider what I had said. And sometime after we left the country and came home, I had a letter from Benny Binnick and also from the African Christians in the Songo country that the Portuguese government had considered the request that we had made and that the ban was lifted and that we were able to go ahead with the work once again. Now just the other day, we had a letter from an African brother at Kapango, and he said that he and another brother, Amadeo from Chilanda, had just been up there and they were able to baptize 48 believers in that area. And they were full of joy. And they were working hard to rebuild the little places where the gospel had been preached. And were thankful for the work. The band has been lifted there and the word is going ahead. Now just a word about Chicago. You know, dear brother, Ed Bondi, when both of you were the Lord, a comparatively short time ago, he came from London, Ontario. After the summer of this afternoon, the new brother, Violet. We had a conference there when we were over, and at that conference, although there hadn't been a mission there for 11 years, we had 1,029 believers at the conference, although no missionary had been there all that time. There were two of the assemblies in the Chicago area were completely wiped out by Portuguese troops. All the leaders shot, and nothing left but a few women and children, but all of those that carried on the work there were wiped out. But we're thankful that today the work at Chicago is going ahead with the blessing of God upon it. And at the conference there, as I say, we had 1,029 by actual count at that conference on a weekend. It was the 50th anniversary of the founding of the work by Ed Bogdan. And then we went over to Monte Esperanza. This was one of the final places that we visited before we left. We went over there with Teddy Biddy, and we heard some very, very pathetic stories of what had happened to the elders there. They too had been practically wiped out. These are men that we know, Kalende, and Tina, and all of the elders there we have known for 50 years. But many of these men, they were killed, and it just seemed that an effort was made to completely wipe out the work. Now, it hasn't been destroyed. When we went there to see Dr. Woodward's hospital, occupied by soldiers, Charlie Sharpton's house, occupied by the security police, and the survivors of what I've been speaking about, living at the bottom of the hill in little villages at the bottom of the hill. When we were there last year, we had a conference at the weekend. There were 740 people at the conference. And ministry was carried on in 4 different languages. And when we were leaving, they came to us and they gave us money to pay our expenses for getting there. Now, we didn't want the money. We didn't need the money. And we would gladly have told them to keep their money. But you know, it would have been wrong as it said. And you know, it just about broke us up. See those people that have gone through so much. And the very fact that we've come and opened the Word of God and tried to encourage them, they acted in pay for expenses for getting there. Just the other day, as a matter of fact, yesterday when I came to the conference, I heard that Charlie Sharp had a season for the fact. We have been praying about this. And we just heard yesterday from Ross Woodward when we came to the conference that his visa, a permanent visa, has been granted to Charlie to go back again to Monte Esperanza. I would like to go there. And Charlie talked up. I know the kind of an experience that he's had. It will be a very emotional experience after the Lord has taken Winfrey home and to see Charlie go back again. I would love to go there if he gets back again. So please pray for Angola. There are many, many other things that one could have said about it. I'm trying to restrain myself and not going into detail of what has happened to some of the Christians. But it has been purified by fire. And we thank God that it's on a solid foundation today. And the work is going ahead in the hands of African breath. And we do need to pray that God would open the door as a result of the revolution that is taking place in Portugal and that the door may be kept open for the spread of the gospel in this beloved land. So I just want to occupy maybe about 10 minutes speaking about India. Again, last year we had the privilege, after coming back from Africa, of the invitation of Indian brethren to go over there for a series of conferences among the assemblies in that land. The man that was responsible for me going there was Mr. J.M. Davis. He was a man who spent 40 years in the south of India in the state of Kerala. And by the way, Mr. Davis, the Indian people told me he had a marvelous knowledge of the Malayalam language. To say if he was behind a tree speaking Malayalam, that they wouldn't be able to tell the difference whether it was an Indian brother or whether it was a missionary. He had a wonderful knowledge of the Malayalam language. You know, here again, one hardly knows where to start. But it was Mr. Davis, anyway, suggested that I go over and spend about 3.5 months over in the country in the ministry of the word among the Indian assemblies. Now, just to give you the overall picture, in India today, there must be approximately about 800 assemblies. Now, these assemblies are concentrated in two main areas. First of all, in Kerala, that is in the south of India, there must be about 200 assemblies there. That is a conservative figure. And then, if I flash the board on the Godavery, in that area today, there are approximately 400 assemblies. Now, the men who started the work on the Godavery, as you probably know, Anthony Norris Groves, one of those early brethren. And 150 years ago, at the time of Darby and John G. Bellet and Lord Congleton, and these men, Anthony Norris Groves, went to India. And he settled there on the Godavery, and he was the man who pioneered the work. And at that area today, there are approximately 400 assemblies in the Godavery area. Now, the first place I went to, going over there on the 18th of December last year, was Bombay. I had a week of meetings in Bombay. There are 14 assemblies in Bombay. And the man who started the work there was Mr. Henry Bird. His name may be known to some of the older brethren here this afternoon. Dear, dear man of God. An outstanding man. He pioneered the work in Bombay and also in Madras. And in Bombay there are 14 assemblies today. I had a meeting there, a meeting at 7 o'clock in the morning, and another one at 7:30 at night. 2 meetings a day. And on the Lord's Day, they had a conference in one of the buildings in Bombay. And there were over 700 people at that conference. The breaking of bread meeting lasted for about 3 hours, and when one spoke in English, I had 2 interpreters, so that it took just about 3 times as long to deliver a message among the people. It's quite an experience to speak my interpretation in that way. I'm 2 men standing at your side speaking one language and another man on the other side speaking another language. But oh, what a joy it was to see how God has blessed his work there in Bombay. From there I came over to Madras and I had a conference there of workers, Indian evangelists, all connected to the assemblies, commended from the assembly, and that are scattered over the whole of India, particularly in the north. There were 175 evangelists at that week, and it was a very great joy to listen. I was about to talk about them, some of the individuals. As you know, today it's most difficult for anyone from this country, or any foreign country, to get a visa that went through India. Before I went there, the first thing I had to do was to have the word missionary eliminated from my passport. If I had done the word missionary, I wouldn't have been allowed to enter the country. I had to have that taken off. Missionary is a bad word in India today. And anybody without a passport probably would not be allowed to enter. Mr. Davies suggested that instead of the word missionary, I should put the word teacher there. That's what they did on the left behind on that. So I did it anyway. And first of all, in Bombay, and then down in Madras at this workers' conference, and then down in Kerala. By the first conference, there were 8 of them all together, over there at the Common Convention. And there were eight of them all together, and at the first one, there were 3,000 people present. And the breaking of bread meeting at Cumbernet on Sunday morning lasted for 4.5 hours. I can imagine some people, if they were sitting on the ground, cross-legged on the ground for 4.5 hours, they might be a little bit tired. After the breaking of bread, there was an old gentleman, an Indian brother. He got up and he spoke for 1 hour and 20 minutes without drawing a breath. After the breaking of bread, I think I could see people shifting in their seats if anybody attempted to do that here. But everybody was quite, it seemed quite normally. I was up to describe the proceedings in the breaking of bread. I'm not going to take time to do it, but to me it was a thrill to see that large company of people, 3,000 of them, gathered together to remember the Lord, and it lasted for 1.5 hours. There I learned to eat with my fingers Korean rice 3 times a day. And I learned a lot of other things as well. Mm-hmm. You know, any visitor going in there would immediately see the difference between, at least anybody from Africa, would immediately see the difference between Africa and India. Again, I can't take time to describe that. But one thing that impressed me very much was the tremendous population of that time. 575 million people.